Great to have you along on the Ideas Network. Time to turn our attention to the weather and climate with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and also professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. John Martin is professor and chair of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at UW-Madison. So great to have our weather guys back. They come by the last Monday of every month. Here they are again. Your opportunity to ask them some questions about weather and climate. And I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page and post a question there at the Larry Mueller Show. Or if you have some, we've had some great photos over the last 6-8 months. People have sent photos of various cloud formations and stuff, and that's kind of fun to see, isn't it?
Yeah, a lot of people caught that isolated cumulus cloud. I don't know when it was, middle or early part of last week or something. Really beautiful.
Yeah.
Spectacular. It's on our website, department website now.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, we've had some heat.
Mm-hmm. This ain't weather I kind of like.
No. There aren't really a huge number of fans of what we had last week, I don't think. I'm not one of them.
Oh, man. And what, so the cooler temperatures were stalled up in Canada or something?
Well, when there's a big ridge of high pressure, it's not just at the surface. It tends to be also all the way through the lowest part of the middle part of the troposphere, and that ensures that cooler air is well north of the northern boundary of that ridge, which was southern Canada at the very closest to us. So we just cooked underneath that fairly clear skies every day, a lot of corn evapotranspirating water into the air, and then low-level moisture advection off the Gulf of Mexico combining to raise the dew points to 80. We hadn't had an 81 dew point in Madison, I think, since 1995, and we did last Monday.
81, that's like, I mean, I spent part of last week in Florida, in Tampa Bay. And when I came back to Madison, it was hotter.
I heard the same from someone who came back from D.C. Middle of last week.
Oh, yeah.
It's exactly
like,
the same
thing.
This
isn't right.
And, you know, this was the time that I chose. We had someone had put a fence in at our back lawn, which we were trying to get rid of. And there was they had cemented in with a fairly large piece.
And you're back there trying to dig it out?
I'm sitting there with a pick breaking up the cement,
whoa,
the concrete.
You know, in heat waves, you're not supposed to exert yourself.
I'm still feeling it in my arms.
You might pay attention to the radio, Larry. They sometimes tell you things like this.
Sometimes the weather guys get on and talk about the danger.
Man, oh man.
Working on a chain gang on his vacation.
Yeah, well, my wife was painting the outside of our garage in the same heat, so it was...
Oh man.
Jeez. Wasn't the smartest thing in the world I've ever done. Pete in La Crosse has a question for you guys. Hi, Pete.
Hi. Good morning to professors all. I have a question about climate change and atmospheric dust. I'm of the opinion that atmospheric dust levels, and there's lots of causes, but economic activity is certainly one of those causes. And we saw a lot of hot weather in the 1930s when economic activity was somewhat at a lull. And now we're seeing a lot of hot weather when economic activity seems to be at a lull as well. Can you inform us as far as any historic monitoring of dust levels and any kind of correspondence it might have as far as its contribution to climate change?
But that's a good question. We do monitor dust reports from surface observations. That's one of the standard observations that weather observers will make. And as well as from satellites. Now that we can really have satellites over Africa, we can really monitor what's coming off the African continent from the Sahara, and there's huge amounts of dust that come off of Africa. But with regard to climate change, I mean, we're seeing dust outbreaks now as well, and I'm not so sure if it's directly associated with hard economic times or drought type conditions, because in where we're getting a lot of dust now, I mean, in Texas and the Southwest and even the far Southeast are undergoing really drought conditions. And that, of course, dries out the soil. And then if you do any kind of traveling or disturbance of the vegetation on that surface, then you can kick up dust.
Yeah, and there's all kinds of different dusts. People do it. It's a real science all to itself. And from the atmospheric side of it, we more or less understand something about some of the wind events that can come along and loft it and get it in the air. But as Steve was pointing out, drought is a really strongly correlated phenomena that goes along with dust. But even in parts of some parts of West Texas, if you have 5 days in a row without rain and a big surface wind gust event comes along, you are going to loft some of that dust. So it doesn't take a long period of dryness in certain locations, Gobi Deserts and other places like that, and then the Sahara that you mentioned off of Africa. So dust is a major part of the climate system, but we don't think that it has too much to do with, it's one of the few that maybe doesn't have that great amount to do with human intervention.
Okay, dust levels actually high at this time?
I don't know. I know that another way that people track it is they go in deep historical records through Greenland ice cores. You can figure out how much dust was falling with the snow in a given season that might have accumulated to the growth of the ice. And that isn't constant. It's variable. And the exact conditions for why it varies, even in the remote past, is not very well understood. I don't know if there's a way to say, a month after a big dust event, whether or not the globe has had more dust around it this month of June than it did in June of 2008. I'm not sure about that.
Okay.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have a Tim in Chippewa Falls wonders, what's the best way to measure rainfall? What kind of container, or straight, or other kinds of?
Yeah, precipitation. Measuring precipitation is hard. So the best thing to do is to get an official rain gauge, because they try and take care of that the best. The problem with measuring rainfall is that if there's any kind of wind associated with it, or if you don't have it in an open area, you can get additional precipitation or water in there that really isn't associated with the precipitation.
Yeah, I think the exposure is probably the primary thing. I mean, most people live here in the city like I do. You have a small little plot of land. Most of it's vegetated with big trees. I couldn't put a rain gauge out anywhere around my house and really count on the accuracy of it. I'd need like a big baseball field size area.
Yeah.
Put it right in the middle of the pitcher's mound or something, and then expect that I'm not going to get too much falling water from trees or other things. But then I'd still have the wind issue and some others.
Yeah.
But your advice about the official rain gauge from the Weather
Service. Where do you get an
one.
Official? So does it is the Weather Service? National Weather Service?
The National Weather Service will recommend some.
Okay.
And there's also a group called COCORAS. COCORAS.
Cooperative something?
Yeah, it's a cooperative group that measures hail, rain, and snowfall. And I forget what it stands for.
Yeah, cooperative something.
But H&R are hail and rain.
And it must be observers or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Judy in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Hi, Judy. Judy, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling.
You bet. Yeah, listen, we've had a lot of tornadoes in the country, and mostly they're on flat lands. And I was just wondering if the tornado tails will go up and down hills, and I'll hang up in here. Mm-hmm.
Once they form, they'll go up and down hills. I mean, we don't get any in the mountainous regions, mostly because to get tornadoes to form in the U.S., the ideal conditions are in areas where it's flat.
Yeah, the higher the elevation is, as you go to the western United States, the less water vapor is in the air that makes contact with the ground. And I think that's a big issue because then the amount of what we call instability in the atmosphere is considerably lower at Denver on any given day than it is, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where there's a deeper layer of a lot of water vapor. So that's a big factor.
Yeah. But it's slowed down, right? The tornado season is kind of... We started off with a really big bang.
Right. As the caller was making that comment, I thought the same thing, is that it really did start out in April and May and maybe even early June as really this disastrous thing. And it still, I think, exceeds the average by a lot, even through then. But we didn't really have too much activity in July. Part of it is because of our big heat wave event that lasted more than a week in the central part of the U.S. And then spread to the East Coast, and that's a tornado killer. You don't get them in that case. So you take 10 days out of a month of July with no chance for a tornado, you start to hurt your numbers a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
Phil in Hebron, Illinois, we're on to you now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, you guys. I'll give you a number before I give you my question. On Friday morning at 8 a.m., we picked up, you're talking about rain gauges. I got 2.45 inches in 14 minutes here.
Wow. You near Chicago?
Right on the state line, immediately below Lake Geneva, and those trailing storms just walked over us one after another.
That was an amazing event. I've been reading about this a little bit on a chat line that a bunch of meteorologists around the country have. This was a 5 standard deviation or more from the average event.
So this is amazing.
That's an astounding amount of rain in 14 minutes. Absolutely stunning.
My question for you is, I've got a buddy here who plants about 8 square miles of corn around me, and I'm standing in some greenhouses looking at his corn every day, and when he comes out here, he says, when you're cussing out the humidity, you're cussing out me 10%.
Oh, yeah.
Is he bringing up the humidity 10%?
Probably easily.
Yeah.
Yep, at this time of year. Now, it changes during the growing season. By the time it's end of August, not so much. But right now, the corn is probably at its worst in terms of managing water, so he's right on.
Okay, thank you.
But be nice to him.
Yeah, be nice to him anyway.
If it's sweet corn, maybe he'll give you some.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. You can even eat field corn as sweet corn.
How does it taste, field corn? I mean, I would think it'd be very
actually good. You catch it right. You don't want to have it into the dense stage.
Okay, right,
But when it's early, I had a friend who had field corn, and he said, you know, invited everybody over for a big sweet corn or a big corn roast, and he grilled right in the husks, and man, it was delicious. Mm-hmm.
I guess you put enough butter on it, good Wisconsin butter, and it'll be good.
Well, we actually picked the ears of corn, carried them over to the boiling or to the. I mean, they were done within minutes.
Of being picked.
And that's when the sugar content's going to be the highest.
There's a lot of water in the cob, maybe, too. You can suck it out when you steam them like that or when you grill them like that. Maybe that keeps it moist.
Oh, right, yeah.
I don't know.
It could be, but all I know is I have fond remembrances of that.
Yeah.
And oftentimes, driving by other cornfields, I had the urge to stop and visit the corn and
start a grill.
Right.
Check the ears for make sure that everything is okay with this particular cornfield.
And you're providing a service, Len.
Providing a service. I have yet to actually take one, though. Oh, boy. We're talking corn right now, but we'll soon be back to weather. Actually, corn does have an effect on our weather. With our two guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys, with us the last Monday of every month, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Weather is the backdrop for pretty much everything we do, but sometimes it really asserts itself and moves to center stage. And last week, it was the extreme heat and humidity that taxed our cooling systems for buildings and bodies and a fair amount of tempers, too. If your experience was anything like mine, I'm Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along on the Ideas Network as we visit with our weather guys from the UW-Madison, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They're here to share what they know about climate and weather, and they'll tell us what the rest of the summer is going to look like for Wisconsin, I hope. Well, I'm going to ask them anyway. You can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And don't forget to check our Facebook page for updates and to post your comments and photos as well. Hope you'll stay tuned. We'll be back right after this look at the news here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. Steve is also director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John chairs the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences Department. So great to have them here, and thank you so much for listening. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, email talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, post something there. Let's go to the phones, and Keith in Port Edwards. Hi, Keith.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Within the last month, up near us in the northern part of Wisconsin, we've had these tremendous horizontal winds that are 75, 80 miles an hour that have caused quite a bit of destructive damage to a number of communities. I wonder just what is the phenomenon going on there.
They're called straight-line winds. And what it is thunderstorms, as they develop vertically, they can pull down some of the high-level winds that are in the upper atmosphere and bring them down to the surface. That's, I think, was what the one that caused the big blowdown in northern Wisconsin a couple of weeks ago, I guess that was.
Yeah, and then the famous one in 99 in the Boundary Waters area was the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And they tend to be along the northern periphery of these ridges that we talked about earlier, these ridges of high pressure in both the lower and upper part of the atmosphere. So those are hot spots. The so-called ring of fire is aptly named. And many of the thunderstorms that populate that northern part of Minnesota, northern part of Wisconsin in the summertime have this straight-line wind damage capability for the reasons Steve suggested.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Steve, you want to reach over and turn on your...
Sure.
Turn the computer on because we've got some photos, and I don't know that I can turn...
Oh, yep, there it is.
All right. This is something this system George caught moving through Lemaira. Here, let me get it up.
Whoa. Shelf cloud.
Yeah.
Or roll cloud. I guess it can be called either one. Sometimes it's called by either one. That's the kind of thing that forms out in front of the sort of the skirt of a thunderstorm, a line of severe thunderstorms. A lot of turbulence in that thing. Even though it looks laminar on the top, if you were in a glider or an aircraft going through that thing, you wouldn't want to do it.
Yeah, it's a roll cloud in that if you don't have the page up, it's like a roll.
Yeah,
you
right.
You can
yeah.
imagine it like a big toilet roll.
That is really something. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show to take a look at that. Oh, my goodness.
That's pretty amazing. And to see it live, of course, as always with these phenomena that are captured by cameras, is just stunning.
Yeah. And that means it's going to rain.
Yeah, right.
You're going to get some rain.
You're going to get some rain.
Kathy in Viroqua, let's go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm wondering how much manipulation of weather is being done or can be done. I understand that seeding clouds is one way of doing something, but I'm wondering if there's anything else. Also, can rain be directed to areas of drought or fires, you know, where there are fires?
Hmm. Cloud seeding is, I think, been largely discredited. Not because it might not work, but because you can't prove that it works. It's so difficult to prove it. Effectively, here's the problem. You fly through a cloud that exists over some location. You seed that cloud with silver iodide. Then maybe the cloud drops a few raindrops. And you sort of suggest that if it had not been seeded, it wouldn't have rained. You can't ever make that conclusion. And even... In the cases, many decades of using cloud seeding as an attempt to, you know, stimulate precipitation, it never stimulated or supposedly stimulated any significant precipitation event. So we're always talking about a few drops of rain that may or may not have come out of these clouds. Mm-hmm. So even that, what does have rather a high profile in the public view of a weather modification attempt is not very, very good one. And I can't think of any others that are even... as close to success, if you could call it that, as cloud seeding. I can't think of one.
Yeah, no, and I think most of the impact that we might have had has always been unintentional.
You know, right.
Like in a,
yeah.
I'm thinking of urban heat island effect. You know, we build these big cities, and in the end, that actually increases the temperature of the city compared to the areas around it. Largely because of destruction of the vegetation, so there's less water evaporation, and then replacing that with things like concrete and things, which can heat up and maintain the heat throughout the evening.
And the one that we've kind of mentioned a couple of times in passing, corn. You know,
right,
500 years ago, the central plains of North America were prairie grasses and forests and not corn stalks. And I think that it probably is arguable that there's more precipitation in the summertime and early fall, well, maybe especially central part of the summertime, in the central part of North America now than there was 500 years ago. And that is a result of weather modification that's
right.
clearly unintentional.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're saying, though, that there's no effective way to manipulate weather for the given result that we're looking for?
It appears the answer to that is no. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Had a caller who couldn't hang on, but wondered if you guys know if there was a tornado around Como Lake near Lake Geneva Friday night or Saturday morning Lots of tree damage there, or was it just high winds?
I don't know. We were in an environment over the end of the week into the weekend that could have sustained straight line winds for sure. I don't know about tornadoes.
Yeah,
that's a good question. I don't know the answer.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if we had the, like you're saying, the real wind shear.
Yeah, right.
To get a storm rotating.
Where
yeah.
would you go to find that out? I mean,
The National Weather Service
or Storm Prediction Center has a website.
Yeah,
if you Google SPC storm reports, then you can get today's and yesterday's storm reports right on the front page that you land on, and then you can scroll down.
Go back.
And you can put in a date. And it'll give you all the storms that were reported. Now, if this actually happened and no one saw the funnel and so on, it might not be reported as a tornado. But if there's damage, almost surely somebody in a place like Lake Geneva is going to report damage.
I would think. We've got an email from Bob in Minocqua. It's, I've been a NOAA COOP or co-op weather observer for 6 years after 4 months of drought. Breaking rain in the summer of 2010, we are currently below average for precipitation for the first 6 months of this year, and it looks like we will be below in July again. Mm-hmm. What does the trend look like for the rest of the year? So they had, you know, kind of got out of it in 2010, mm-hmm. and here we are kind of back into it a little bit.
Yeah, I've noticed the same around my own house, and I don't keep records of precipitation, for reasons we talked about before, but it has not rained very much this summer around here.
Yeah, most of the state is below average for this month, anyway, with regard to precipitation.
Yeah, and he's from Minocqua, so that's northern Wisconsin, and...
And the seasonal outlook for precipitation is, well, you know, pick one.
That's right.
There are equal probabilities of being above, at normal, or below normal. We just don't. There's no real forcing mechanism that allows us to predict it.
Yeah, there's no clear signal. Yeah.
So the month ahead, we've got almost into August. We really don't.
There's no strong reason to believe we're gonna have a big change in what we've had. That's the way I look at it, and I think it's kind of what Steve's saying. Yeah. Although that actually does have the sense of a prediction, but I'd go out there and say it. I mean, I think that in the absence of any obvious signal, there isn't any big reason to expect a change of the status quo for the next month.
Diane in Dubuque, Iowa, has a question for you. Hi, Diane.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about thunder rumbling. It seems like in the past 3-4 years that when we get a storm coming through Dubuque, there is just a very, very long rumble, almost a constant. It can be minutes long sometimes.
Yeah.
Is that a new weather phenomena? Because I've been a lifelong weather observer. I've worked outside many years. I've never noticed this incessant rumbling before.
You know, the other day we had a thunderstorm here in Madison, and I was noticing, too, the rumbling.
I did, too.
It just went on and on. And I don't think there's any change in the characteristics of the thunderstorm or the lightning that's generating it. It's just for some reason, at least in the storm that we were listening to, there was just reverberations going on. The atmospheric structure must have been just right to allow the sound waves to propagate for a long time.
And I tend to notice the rumbling more when we're not sitting right underneath a thunderstorm where you get the occasional really loud crack. So you tend to pay attention more to the momentary blasts as opposed to the background rumbling. And if the main part of the storm is a little bit away from us, then I hear more of the rumbling just because I don't get interrupted by the others.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, so we don't have an answer, but it's been amazing. You hear that one?
Yeah, absolutely. We were sitting out on our front porch.
Oh, okay. Yeah, we were on our back porch, so it wasn't raining by us either.
Wasn't raining by us, but it's just like, is there a plane coming? Renee said, you know, something about a plane.
Yeah, right. It sounded like a long plane.
See, that makes me think, since it's not raining there, you're not getting the really loud crack. You're getting just the rumble.
No, right. It was just the rumble.
Yeah. And so it's never interrupted, and it sounds like it lasts forever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it really has to do with the temperature structure of the atmosphere, because there can be times when you'll hear the roar of a thunder, and then it'll go silent as the sound wave propagates up into the atmosphere and then comes back down again. And then you'll hear it again. And this was an issue that they dealt with in the Civil War as well. You could get these zones of quietness where you don't hear the battle, even though it continues to rage. And if you're on either side of that silent zone, you'll hear the battle raging on. So I'm wondering if there isn't just the right atmospheric conditions that we could actually hear that rumbling for a long time.
And what is the phenomena that would cause the sound to come.
To come back?
Yeah.
Okay.
Come back down.
Okay.
It would be a temperature inversion.
Yeah,
so
reflection.
How sound wave moves is a function of the temperature of the atmosphere.
Okay.
And you may notice that, you know, in terms of sound sounding really crisp in the wintertime versus in the summertime. A lot of that's due to the either the temperature of the atmosphere or the fact that there's snow on the ground, too.
I suppose what we could have been hearing was, like, different rumbles. And so...
Yeah, different bolts of lightning.
It sounded like a continuous...
Yeah. Right.
It really was... It wasn't. It was...
It could have been a couple of
bolts. One rumble going up and coming back
down. Right.
I don't know how else to put it, but that could be, I suppose.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Diane. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Caller who couldn't stay on wondered if the futures trading markets, for corn, soybeans, things, well, practically everything, pork bellies, you name it, they're wondering if the futures trading markets use meteorological data to influence their buying and selling.
Oh, absolutely. I wonder if they use anything else.
Yeah.
I swear to God,
it's really
at the top of the list. The Chicago Board of Trade, the Mercantile Board, they have an enormous meteorological staff and a lot of those big companies that work down there because of exactly that. It's a major factor in agricultural trading.
So do some of your students wind up there? Are you alums?
Occasionally.
Yeah.
It's something that we need to do more of, kind of promoting them to think about. It's not traditionally what they think about when they come in for our degree, but it's certainly they carry out skills that can be well employed in such an endeavor.
What do they think about when they come in?
Forecasting for the National Weather Service, so civil service. Sometimes they think about broadcast meteorology. Sometimes I'd say, 30% or more of them think about graduate school and then maybe a research-type career or another kind of operational career, something along those lines.
So there's a variety of types of jobs out there
people
with that background.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, actually, that's a good thing. We should really be looking at that because the weather impact on the economy is monstrous. And there's a lot of interest now, particularly from NOAA, also looking at the intersection of social sciences with weather in terms of how do people react to warnings, and risk. How do they assess risk? National Weather Service is really interested in trying to do research studies like that so that they could be more effective in communicating weather risks to the society.
And I would say that an outgrowth of that would be certainly an understanding of how the markets respond to the fact that there's something like a forecast even available for 10 days.
Yeah. Right.
It doesn't have to be accurate. Somebody over in the ag school told me that once. They said they don't, the traders don't care if the 10-day forecast is accurate. They do care that it exists at all because it changes the way people think about corn production or soybean production or something like that, even if the forecast is totally wrong.
Wow.
So that's psychological the same way.
Yeah.
And that risk communication is interesting because some of our faculty members in the Department of Life Sciences Communication very interested and do a lot of research in the risk communication area. Dominique Brossard, Dietrich Schreifler, among others. Richard in Eau Claire has a comment or question. Hi, Richard.
Hey. I was just wondering about Eau Claire, Wisconsin. I've been watching weather for a really long time now, and I really look forward to the thunderstorms every year. Except it seems like every time there's a severe thunderstorm heading for our city, as it gets to our city, it splits up and moves around it and then comes back together once it's past us.
It happens in Madison, too.
It happens in every city where someone's waiting for thunderstorms. And I mean it, Richard. It happened to me when I was in Massachusetts as a kid. It does, Steve's right. It does seem to happen in Madison. I'll bet you if you ask the average person on the street, of which you're not part of the population because you like the weather and you're watching it and paying attention to it, they wouldn't notice the same thing. I'm guaranteeing it.
But I've noticed, though, every single time we get a thunderstorm and it starts to do that, if I drive maybe 5-10 miles south towards, the Rock Falls area, that's where, everything just gets really intense every single time. I was just... Could maybe a large hill that kind of separates our city, runs right through the middle, maybe have something to do with it? Or
I'm not prepared to say that it has no effect, because part of the things that keeps these thunderstorms going is convergence of the air at the surface. If you put a big obstacle in the flow of the air at the ground, like a hill, you maybe disrupt the pattern of convergence of the air near the ground to a point where, you know, certain spots, bald spots of, you know, of the land near the hill might not get any more surface convergence, and places to the south or to the north get a little bit extra. And that can be a factor, I think, that helps to split some of these storms. So there may actually be a physical cause, and you may have hit right on top of one of the primary ones that might be there. But no one's ever really spent the money or the time necessary to do a detailed study of exactly this thing, although it would answer questions for a lot of interested people, myself included, to know whether or not that's actually what goes on.
It'd be a tough one to do, though, because you'd have to also get the depth of that inflow layer.
That's right.
To determine whether or not the geography is steep enough.
Yeah, the number of instruments needed to really conclusively come to an answer on that would be cost prohibitive, I think, for the return. Because people would say, well, we don't really care if storms split when they come around Madison. It's not that big a deal. Yeah. But it would be an interesting question, nonetheless, to try and figure out.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks, Richard. And Dave in La Crosse, I'll go to you now. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Mr. Ackerman, I heard that you were working with satellite temperatures and was wondering if your temperature readings square with the Goddard Institute's estimates. They say, I know they've been criticized for overestimating Arctic temperatures over too wide an area. And, you know, if whether you have your own satellite or if you're working with Spencer and Christie at University of Alabama or...
Yeah, no, I don't work with Spencer and Christie at Alabama on this type of topic. They use a lot of microwave type observations. We have some folks here in the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies who use a different instrument to look at Arctic temperatures in particular, as well as global temperatures. And yeah, they're finding that that the Arctic is warming up, and that the rate of warming is different for summer versus winter. And I'm closing my eyes trying to imagine what those maps look like. And I can't remember which one is warming up faster. It was a bit of a surprise to me. I think it was the winter time was warming faster. And part of that was associated with changes in cloud cover, which are also, as you can imagine, are going to tend to keep the atmosphere from cooling down, particularly at nighttime. You know, which is something you'd have to worry about in the Arctic.
I've heard that they were the ice extent was possibly at the lowest it had ever been since they started measuring.
Yeah, that's what's going on right now. Yeah, it's at a minimum. It's a record minimum in terms of ice coverage in the Arctic this year, and it's worse than what it was in 2007. And that was, I think, it was 2007.
Yeah.
It was that really bad year, ice year.
And it doesn't reach its minimum until mid-September.
Right. Yeah. So there's more going away still.
It's going to be bad.
There you go. Thank you for calling. Sort of along those lines, Tom emailed and wondered if you would comment on Al Gore's long-range weather predictions into 2090. Severe drought for most of the USA. Should we be looking for land in Ecuador?
I haven't looked at Al Gore's. He's not a resource I would go to get a long-term forecast.
Same with me. I was thinking the same thing. I was trying to say it as politely as I could, and that far exceeded the way I would. I appreciate the former vice president's interest in the climate problem, but he's not a climate scientist, and so I don't know what projections he may have access to that lead him there. I'm sure there are projections from reputable scientists who come to that conclusion. But my feeling is we don't understand enough about how the climate and weather, which are operating on different scales in time and space, are really interrelated over a period of 8 decades. I'm not prepared to accept any such forecast as something that prompts me to buy real estate somewhere else. So that's how I feel about it.
And we need to learn the economy of the real estate right now. I'm not.
Yeah. It points out how much more we need to learn. And that learning doesn't come cheap, but it's worth it. It's an investment.
And then in that intermediate time zone, you know, where we're looking at weather forecasts of maybe on a week versus seasonal versus 5-6 years.
Right.
You know, 50 years is a lot easier to actually forecast than what it's going to be 3, 4, 5 years out from now.
Jim in Elk Mound has a comment. Jim, hi.
Hello. I've been listening to you guys. I listen to you guys with fascination.
Well, that's good.
Yeah, I think.
Some months ago, another individual called up from the Elk Mound, Eau Claire area, asking a similar question as that fellow I had earlier. And I think it was one of you folks that suggested that there might be an Elk Mound effect.
I don't even know about Elk Mound, so I'm sure I never used those three words together. But
but
that's okay. I mean, I won't disavow what we just said. I think there may well be an effect from local topography on whether or not thunderstorms can actually stay together before they hit a location. But as Steve was pointing out, I think in his comment on that, we'd really need to know what the structure looks like through the whole depth of the lower part of the troposphere, not just at the ground. But it would be a really interesting study. It just would cost money to mount it, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you don't have any grad students that are interested in that right now.
We don't have any rich graduate students.
Who could afford to buy the instruments.
Yeah, we have plenty of graduate students who'd be interested in it, but none of them come with a family fortune.
Oh, thanks, Jim. And guys, thank you so much. The time flew again. We'll look forward to your visit. The last Monday of August. Oh, my goodness.
Summer will be coming to an end.
Just before school starts.
Just before. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin, professor and chair of the Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening. Tomorrow we'll talk about cheese at 11 o'clock and then 11:45. Paddling. Stay with us.
There will be an unprecedented number of recall elections in Wisconsin this summer. I'm Joy Cardine, inviting you to join Ben Marins and me for candidate forums starting this week. The six Republican and two Democratic state senators and their challengers will be invited to answer your questions. Mornings at 7, afternoons at 4, here on the Ideas Network.
Support for WPR comes from Mineral Point, announcing the Cornish Festival and the Gathering of Cornish Cousins, August 10th through 14th, a celebration of Celtic heritage featuring food, dance, theater,